Welcome to the wundersame Fahrradwelt, your cycling podcast about fixed gear, gravel and ultra cycling. Hosted and produced by the one and only Johanna Jahnke.
Hi from Germany. In this podcast episode, I'm talking to Jenny Tuff, one of the most inspiring and successful women in self-support bikepacking racing. She's won both the Silk Road Mountain Race and the Atlas Mountain Race. Besides this, she's a pioneer with world's firsts in trail running, challenging herself to run across a mountain range on every continent. Spoiler, there's only one left to finish this project. Jenny Tuff has traveled to more than 70 countries by herself. We talk about being a woman in the outdoors, solo racing, trail running, and how she prepares for expeditions in countries where women don't have equal rights. She also speaks openly about her own struggle with body image and confidence and the change in perception she wants to be a part of. I'm honored to present you a multifaceted conversation with a wonderful person who shares her values, her experiences, her why, and much more. Enjoy this English podcast episode of Die Wundersame Fahrradwelt. Before we start, I want to introduce you to the supporter of this episode. It's Ortlieb Waterproof, the world's leading brand of waterproof premium equipment. All products are made in Germany, and that means Ortlieb designs and even builds their own machines themselves. Design, product management, advertising, purchasing, production, prototyping, warehousing, simply everything takes place in Germany. Even 70% of purchasing also takes place in Germany. Concerning sustainability, since the beginning of the company, Ortlieb has the possibility to repair bags and also offers to update old bags to newer suspension systems. Ortlieb wants the articles to be used for as long as possible, and therefore they make sure that all individual parts are easily replaceable and give a 5-year warranty. I'm using the fork pack currently. If you're following me on Instagram, you might have seen it already. I've been testing these bags over the winter for more than 6 months, and I'm a fan. Weighing just 290 grams, including the adapter, the fork pack offers approximately 4.1 liters of additional storage space for bikepacking. With the help of the QLS adapter, this ultralight bag with roll closure can be mounted on forks with eyelets or cage mounts intended for this purpose as well. As long as the fork blades sport a constant diameter of 30mm to 42mm. I like cages, but you always have to use a strap or something. With these bags, you can just take them off. You go somewhere, take them off. You can ride on with your bike, leave the luggage, maybe at the place where you are staying. Check them out. Have a look on my Instagram. Have a look at Ortlieb waterproof bags. I link them in the show notes. And now enjoy the podcast with the amazing Jenny Tuff. Jenny, welcome to the show. I'm absolutely stoked to have you on my podcast.
Yeah, I'm really excited to be here. Thanks for having me. And sorry for the only English dialogue.
Well, if you come across anything that may have a double meaning, then tell me. I'm always open for improvement.
Giggle to myself and not tell you.
Well, thank you. Jenny Tuff, when I looked at your website, like the second thing that was stated on the website was, this is the real name, Jenny Tuff.
Yeah. Well, I was getting way too many messages and emails just about that, like, but what's your real name? And I thought, do people think I'm so arrogant that I branded myself as Jenny Tuff? Like, no, it's my real name. Not that cocky.
Well, even if you did, I mean, sorry. It's so cool.
I know, it's an awesome name.
Yeah, it is. Jenny, you're an adventurer a storyteller and a mountain lover. So almost all your adventures have something to do with mountains.
Yeah, usually. Yeah, I mean, I love the sea. I love all environments, but mountains are just that place that I feel totally at home, that my heart is at peace. Even if they're mountains, I don't know. I just get that feeling of I'm home when I'm there.
Yeah, and you grew up in the Canadian Rockies. Is that true? Did I research correctly?
Yeah, you did. Yeah, they're one of the most beautiful places in Canada.
And you're in Canada right now?
Yeah, I'm in a place called Squamish in British Columbia, which is just a small place in the mountains. So, you know, the pandemic is obviously hard on everyone, but I feel so grateful that I've had mountains to get me through this whole thing, and I've always been able to get outside and play in them. So yeah, it's a good pandemic home.
So you're not restricted there. You can just do your own adventures.
Yeah, exactly. All the restrictions are in civilized locations. So we are allowed to go do outdoor sports. You know, they close the ski lifts and stuff now, but we have abundance of trails. And as long as you go by yourself, as you say, you can keep going outside.
And your other home is Scotland?
Yeah, I'm half Scottish, half Canadian. Lived in Scotland for the past 9 years, so it's very much, my home. And I'm definitely missing it now. It's kind of weird not being able to get back, you know, with obviously restrictions. And even if there weren't restrictions, there are no flights. So I'm feeling a little bit homesick for Scotland these days.
Because I wasn't sure when you told me you were in Canada, I was like, okay, but where is she actually from?
Yeah, I came out here this summer to do a run on the Rocky Mountains and then just basically didn't get back, and COVID came in, so I had to settle, get a place to live and settle down. So I stayed on the Canadian side.
Okay, now I understand. Yeah, so you just mentioned it briefly. You're doing a project right now running across the mountain ranges of 5 continents or 6? 6. And you have done 5.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this project I started 4 years ago when I ran across Kyrgyzstan and the central Tian Shan mountains. And at the time, it was just going to be the one-off, and it was by far the hardest thing I'd ever done. You know, it was a world-first expedition. There was no trail. There was no help on logistics, and I did it unsupported. And it was so hard. It was 1,000 kilometers, and it took me 25 days. And I mean, I was just in such bad shape afterwards. It was so brutally difficult. But you know that type 2 fun thing when you get home and you just think to yourself, man, I was alive out there. Like, that was the best time I ever had. I want to do that again. And like a sucker for punishment, you sign up for the next thing. And for me, that I just knew I wanted to do more of that. It just feels like the perfect challenge for me when I go from the start of one mountain range and traverse the entire thing and meet the communities amongst it and see the environment of the mountains and then get to the other end of it. Having gotten to know those mountains so well, it's just, you know, it's a totally made up challenge. You know, it's not something that I signed up for. It's something that I invented, but it works perfectly for me, and I'm just really loving it. Yeah, I just made up this thing that I would do a mountain range on every continent and learn about mountain culture that way by seeing mountain people on all sides of the world. And so far, I mean, I'm not done, so I won't say what the conclusion of the challenge is, but so far what I'm definitely finding is that there's just something to mountain people. Like, these inhospitable environments have the kindest people in them. And, you know, I've met really different people on this trip. You know, in Kyrgyzstan, it was the nomads who live in yurts. In the Atlas Mountains, it was the Berbers. And, you know, and then I went to New Zealand, where it was more like people who looked exactly like me, who were just outdoor sport enthusiasts. But they've all had this commonality of just this love for the environment that they're in and this understanding of needing to look out for each other when we're in these kind of environments. So it's been a really humbling experience.
Sounds amazing. And like, can you compare these different mountain ranges? Like, what was difficult in certain areas compared to others?
Yeah, no, they've all been so different, which has been amazing. So I'm definitely not getting bored having done all this. They've been so, so different, and they've all given me a different lesson that I maybe needed at that point in my life. New Zealand was a funny one because that was my 4th range, and it was the first time doing it in a Western country. And I was kind of worried going into it that I'd let myself down, that it was going to be too easy, because the first three had all been world first. So a trail didn't exist. There weren't really good maps that I could get. So I really had to do a lot of work before I started to figure out a route and how I was going to survive. Whereas New Zealand, you know, there were GPX files for the entire way. Like, it wasn't. So I thought to myself that maybe I let this challenge down, that I was doing an easy one. But man, the thing that I underestimated was how difficult the trails were. Because, of course, in the developing world, so Kyrgyzstan, Morocco, and Bolivia being the first three, trails only exist for transportation, for people to get to the next village to trade goods or get to school or work or whatever. But in places like New Zealand and in Europe and in Canada, trails exist for leisure. So, you know, they're intentionally a little bit more difficult. And that was, man, the Southern Alps, New Zealand, I don't know if you've been, but they are, like, so many of the routes I think in Europe would be a via ferrata. They're just so technically challenging, which was amazing. But then I was going so slow. So I had it in my mind that this is going to be the easiest run, but actually, physically, it was by far the hardest.
I followed the Tour.
Yeah, I can't say it either. I know what you're talking about.
I'm going to put it in the show notes. But the first, the in
Tour Tara or something like that. I can't say it.
I should
have. I know, I can't pronounce anything Kiwi.
Yeah, I can, in fact, but I just forgot the name. The first bikepacking race on the South Island of New Zealand, actually.
Yeah. It looked good.
And I followed the trails there, and I can, like, I know what you mean when you talk about difficult trails, because it's more climbing and, yeah, up rocks and, yeah, down other rocks. And and you usually, when you do your runs, you do, like, almost a marathon a day.
Yeah. I mean, I try not to focus on the numbers, because it just seems kind of trivial, I think. With everything that you've got, that I've got going on doing these, that I'm unsupported, so I have to, you know, carry my stuff, I have to make my resupplies, I have to manage my safety, which has been a real issue on a lot of them, and navigation. Like, the running is just the easiest part. You know, I've been running since I was a teenager. It's just right, left, keep going. And so I do push my body to severe physical exhaustion, but I always say that the running is by far the easiest part of these. And it's kind of like my holiday, like my mental holiday within everything else being chaos, the way that an expedition is. Then I just get to, you know, run these little strips in between and have a nice time before I have to figure out again, where am I going to get enough water? Where am I going to sleep tonight? How am I going to keep myself alive or whatever it is?
Since this is more a cycling podcast, but we know that a lot of these ultra endurance cyclists have also been runners. How do you believe these two compare to each other?
You know, they're so different to me. I mean, I couldn't be without cycling and I couldn't be without running. And I always get asked which one's my favorite, and I need them both. But I mean, they're both completely different ways of moving to me. I think bicycles, for me, are a lot more, or at least the way that I ride is a lot more community-based. I mean, bicycles are this amazing connector that if you roll into any town anywhere in the world on a bicycle, people will just instantly kind of understand you at that level. Like, there will be this connection because bicycles exist everywhere, whereas running actually doesn't. So running's a little bit more solitude for me. So cycling, I think, it's a great way to meet people, to be part of communities, and to see the world. And that's what got me into cycling, was only from the perspective of wanting to travel more and do touring. And then when I started to get into the racing, it was just kind of like an extreme level of touring for me.
And you did, this is interesting for the listeners, you did the Transatlantic Way Race, the Silk Road Mountain Race, and we've talked a lot about the Silk Road Mountain Race in this podcast, and the Atlas Mountain Race, and this has also been a topic in this podcast. And especially for women, I've had Andrea Seiermann here, and I know you know her.
Yes.
Big fan.
Yeah, me too. And there were issues, and you mentioned them before. I mean, there are always issues if you go on an expedition in foreign countries. You have to get food, water, sleep, whatever. And especially for women, there are extra issues in races that take place in countries like Morocco, for example. How are your experiences concerning that?
I mean, so I ran across the Atlas Mountains alone 2 years prior to the race as part of my running challenge. So, and that had been really intense to be in a place like that alone. It was really difficult. I mean, I would just call it in places dehumanizing the way that you can be treated in some parts of North Africa. You know, I think we should just be honest about the fact that it's one of the worst places in the world to be a woman. And, you know, I experienced that, and that was important to me to experience that, to understand how, you know, our sisters on this planet all live. So when I went back for the race, I think I was really braced for it because I knew how bad it could be. But also I was really excited that there were 200 racers. So I knew I wasn't alone out there, and that did make a really big difference. But the fact was, we weren't there on holiday. You know, we were there to compete, and we were meant to be competing on even grounds, and we absolutely weren't. The women in the race had a way harder time. We had a lot more to take care of. And I think the positive from that was that it really did open the dialogue in our community, because everyone saw that. Everyone who watched the race, everyone who competed in the race, the people who put on the race, all saw quite clearly that there were real hazards for us that we had to tackle in order to compete. And yeah, it opened the dialogue. It opened everyone's eyes to, you know, this is what it's like to be a female cyclist. You know, it's worse in some parts of the world, but it exists everywhere, that we have these extra concerns. And so, you know, the more we talk about it, the closer we get to fixing it.
Do you think it's possible to fix it in a race like that? I mean, to make it even for men and women competing?
That's a really good question. I'm really not sure, and it's something that I've thought about a lot. I know the other women who are in the race and the race director himself. I know we've all spent the last year thinking about that quite a lot and talking about that. I think unless you can take it in the scope to fix an entire nation of people, no, I think a race like that, you're not competing on even grounds. And I think that women should absolutely compete in that race. And I saw the list came out, and there are going to be more women next or this year than there were last year, which I'm really excited about. But I think we still have to celebrate the women's race the way that they did it for me and Andrea, which was great, because obviously Andrea and I didn't officially come first and second. We came wherever we were in the pack, but the community really did celebrate us as first and second women. And when we do that, that gives meaning to the competition that the women are putting up with.
Well, to explain this to the listeners, there's only one ranking usually in these races, a mixed ranking. And by celebrating you and Andrea for your achievement, it shows that, I mean, it is a special achievement to finish it as a woman in Morocco. I've been talking about this a lot in this podcast, and it's been a while ago now because the race took place a year ago, and Andrea was here on the podcast. Magnus from Road Bike Party Channel was here.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I know there have been changes now. What are the main changes?
Like I said, having the dialogue really open just changed everything for us, because suddenly everyone around us was aware of this and really wanted to take care of us. And, you know, there was a shift that happened while the race was on. I think it was maybe day two or three, that they made extra safety precautions for the women. They changed our spot tracker. So for those who don't know, you have to carry a spot tracker with you so that we can see where you are at all times. And they have SOS buttons. So the race did make that, to extend a bit more safety to the women on that grounds, so that if we were ever in trouble, someone would come a little bit faster. But the big one for me was how much the guys in the race, that nearly 200
pack of men on bicycles just really held an awareness to it. They knew that I was competing not with them on even grounds, like as in if I was faster than them, they would lose to me. But there was just this sensitivity when we were in urban environments, when we went through the villages and the resupply locations, that whichever guys were riding near the women, they would totally look out for us. Because if, you know, if you're riding with a group of people, you're just way stronger and way more protected. And that just continues to humble me when I look back on my Atlas race experiences. The men that I raced with were just so lovely in making sure that we felt safe.
The community is amazing. Really, every time I'm going to even small adventures, it's just so amazing. Everyone is so helpful. Even though if you're in the race, you aren't usually allowed to help.
Yeah, exactly. And you can't plan for that. I think that's why anyone would be nervous about going into an event like this, because you can't know that for sure. You can't plan. You can't say like, oh, I'm sure that I'll find someone to be nice to me. You don't know that, but then you get there and it turns out, yeah, everyone in this community has just got a good soul.
Going back to the Silk Road Mountain Race, which, if I'm correct, was your first mountain bike bikepacking race.
Yeah, I definitely didn't even mountain bike at all.
I know. So you didn't own a mountain bike, but you signed up for the race.
No, I didn't own a mountain bike. Didn't know how to mountain bike. Yeah, well, it was in Kyrgyzstan, right? And like, I just really loved Kyrgyzstan. I think if Nelson had put on that race anywhere else in the world, I wouldn't have been stupid enough to sign up. But because it was Kyrgyzstan, I just had this FOMO and I was like, no, it would kill me not to go. And God, I was so scared when I got close to the race and I realized how out of my depth I was. You know, when the start list came out and it was 100 riders for the inaugural race, and it was like the who's who of the best mountain bike racers in the world. And I was just looking at this going, oh God, what have I done? This is going to be brutal. I'm going to hurt myself.
Yeah, I read somewhere that in the bike races, you were afraid of the mechanical side of cycling.
Yeah, there's definitely that extra layer. I mean, yeah, I can fix basic things, but then, you know, what if something happens? Like, you know, one guy got hit, like, I mean, he was fine, it wasn't a serious accident, but his bike got hit by a car, and, you know, and then his wheel was broken, and that was that for his race. And, like, you know, things like that, that doesn't happen in running. That's why I think I gravitate to running sometimes, is because of the minimalism of it. You know, it's so basic, you can just go outside and do it, whereas a bicycle needs to be maintained, and I'm too lazy.
Yeah, I can totally feel you there. And what's so special about Kyrgyzstan?
Oh, it is a magical place. So, I mean, the mountains themselves, the Tian Shan, which the translation to that is mountains of heaven. And it's just so appropriate. I mean, they're just some of the most beautiful mountains in the world. But the country itself is not very developed. And since the Soviets left, which is, I guess, 27 years ago, something like that, the nomads have gone back to their nomadic way of life. So you go into these fantastic mountains and then you meet this incredible group of people who live in yurts and they live outside and they just live and breathe this mountain environment, and they really share that love with you, and they're really kind. And, you know, it's just unending adventure. I mean, yeah, there's no place like it that I've ever been.
Well, maybe I have to one day.
Put it on the list, girl.
With your mountain ranges, how many of those mountain ranges do you cross? Is it like one or two per year, or can you do more? Because I mean, imagine it's also very tough on your body to do it.
Yeah, it's tough on my body, but it's also, I mean, I have to be away for about 6 weeks. You know, they take, most of them have taken me around 20 to 25 days to finish. So then you add in the time you spent getting to the country and acclimatizing to the altitude. You know, it takes a lot out of my life. I have to be out of office for that long. And I think that's the part that's really hard. And also, you just get a really short window of opportunity. You know, most of the ranges I only have between June and September to do it. So that's been the biggest thing that slowed me down, is just I have to wait for the specific weather window for each range. So, you know, if COVID hadn't happened, I really wanted to bang out two last year and get it done. But, you know, that obviously wasn't going to happen. So I had to wait another year that hopefully this summer I will finish. So, yeah, it's taken me 4.5 years so far. So it might be a total of 5 years to finish this project. Just sounds insane when I say that out loud.
Yeah, but also not so insane. I mean, it's good to have such projects and maybe...
I'm a very impatient person. Oh, so 5 years for me is like, whoa. I mean, that's most of my life. Oh my God.
Yeah. Do you have anything planned for afterwards? So you have another big project or...
Yeah. So I think that's actually the hardest part of recovery. It's not the physical side. It's the mental side. And it's something that I experienced at the end of every mountain range that I did so far, is there's just this dip afterwards, because this project just encompassed your entire world and all your focus. And everyone will know this, whether or not it's a sport project like a race or something you do at work. Like when you finish something really big, there's just a little bit of an emptiness afterwards. So I'm really scared of the day that I finish the last mountain range, because then if I don't have something to go to next, I think I'll just be really sad. So yeah, it's a good question, and one that I need to know what the answer is before I finish the mountain range, or else I'll get depressed. I think in all likelihood, I honestly think I'll just keep going. Like I really love this mountain range project, and so I think I'll just go back and do it on a bicycle and just pick another 6 mountain ranges on every continent and start cycling across them.
That's very smart.
Yeah, I think so.
The mental health game is an important one to play. And I did some research, and most research you find about post-race depression or post-event depression is from people running across mountains.
Ah.
It's interesting. Not so much from cycling, because I think when you cycle, you almost always... closer to other people, I don't know.
Yeah, that does actually make sense. Because I get, I've always found it on the last day, I have a really hard time, because that last day is always going to be a downhill run, obviously, from the mountains down into whatever city is where I fly home from or whatever. And I always find that transition of running from the Alpine and then coming down and like being able to hear the city first and then smell it and like... yeah, it just that sense overwhelm of what a city can be. And I always just find that day going back to civilization. I mean, you always think you'll look forward to it, that you'll get this clean hotel room with a bed and you'll get something to eat and you'll have a hot shower. And like, honestly, those things just in that moment of that last day, I despise them. I don't want to go back to the city. I don't want to go back to man-made things. It's a real shock to the system to transition back to humanity.
Yeah, it's almost as if you have to acclimatize before and after.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And I never plan for the after part. And that's, I think, the biggest mistake I've made in the past is not totally underestimating the process of coming home and finishing something.
Okay, you didn't prepare for it. Maybe, I mean, you have one more. You can practice preparing.
Yeah, you never know.
It might work. But anyhow, you did have to acclimatize back into reality. And how did you do that? Are there any things that help you?
I guess going easier on myself with it. So I know it always looks really strange to my friends, but as soon as I get home, I typically go away camping for a night or two, and they're like, but didn't you just get back? And I just kind of like, I can't be inside all the time, I need to go out again. So there's that, just kind of like easing yourself into it. But the biggest one for me is just knowing what's next, so you don't come back to this empty hole of I don't have anything to work on anymore. I decide before I get there, I know that when I get home, I've got something next to look forward to and sink my teeth into. So just knowing it's there, even if I don't have the energy to deal with it right now, because I'm probably exhausted in quite a lot of ways. But just knowing that it's there will keep me from going into that despairing, what am I doing kind of hole that you can fall into.
That's a good trick. You probably know Jonas Deichmann, who's currently...
Oh my gosh, have you seen his photos lately in Russia? God, he's kind of killing me. Yeah, he's hardcore.
Yeah, he's been on the podcast twice, and I've talked a lot to him also privately, of course. And what he does is anytime he's on an expedition like this or on a record attempt like this, he's already planning the next one. So he has a plan. Yeah. He comes back and he's basically has a plan what for the next adventure to come. Yeah.
That's totally the way to do it.
Yeah, it's it seems to work.
I feel validated if he does that too.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's on a high level.
Yeah, so are you. I was wondering, I heard or read somewhere that you never call yourself an athlete. Why not?
Gosh, no. That's a strong word. I don't know. I really don't see myself that way. And I do struggle with confidence. Like, to be fair, I do have low self-esteem. So there's definitely a bit of that coming into play. And there's also... something I've really thought about a lot in the last couple of years is how much of that comes from body image. You know, I mean, I'm not fat in a medical sense at all, but especially in cycling and in running, like, I mean, go into any store and a magazine rack and look at the people who are on the cover of all the cycling and all the running and all the fitness magazines. And they definitely don't look like me. And I think that always kind of played into it when I was around cycling or running, and I would just say like, oh, I do this sport, but you know, I'm not competitive, I'm not an athlete, I'm just an avid enthusiast. So I've always really shied away from that word. Whether I'm right or wrong, I'm not really sure, but
definitely wrong there. Sorry.
Oh, okay.
But I mean, it's okay to, I mean, everyone can call themselves whatever they want, of course.
No, and I totally agree with you. And I would, if I were in your shoes right now, I'd say the same thing to me. But, you know, our own self-esteem is our own mystery, isn't it?
It's very interesting. And I mean, I've been following you for a while, and I know that once you wrote, because you do write about these things on Instagram as well, and you wrote about this cover shooting.
Oh my gosh.
And didn't feel, yeah, I mean, tell us what happened there.
So I was in a rough period of my life. You know, I'd just been through a breakup and I just decided to hibernate. And then I got this message saying, do you want to be on the cover of Women's Running? And I was like, oh my gosh, that's a huge opportunity. But the shoot was next week and I was like, oh, no, can't do that. But then, you know, I had a word with myself that, you know, someone's got to be on the cover. It might as well be you. So I went down to London and I did the shoot. And then when it came out, you know, these things always take really long time. So you do the shoot kind of months before the magazine comes out. And when it came out, I remember I walked into a supermarket in Scotland and there I was on the magazine rack, and I mean, I was just horrified. That was my first reaction, was it was such an unflattering photo. It was, I just looked so large and I was just so upset. And that was all I could see. I couldn't see anything else except for like the shape of my body. And so of course, at first I was kind of upset about that. But then I stopped and I thought back on my life. You know, when I started running, I was a teenager and I only did it because I was gaining weight and I wanted to be thinner. And so I got really into running. I remember I always went to magazine racks and I would buy running magazines because I was just really getting obsessed with the sport. And on the cover, there would always be some girl in a sports bra and just impossibly thin. And I just thought, if I just keep on running, I will eventually get there. I'll look like her. And that was the goal. And So yeah, when this cover of me came out, I just thought, you know, I personally don't like that I look that way. But man, if I had seen that when I was 16 years old, if I had seen someone that size saying, look, I've run across entire mountain ranges, I can do a marathon a day back to back, and this is what my body looks like, you know, that would have changed my relationship with my body if I'd had that intervention when I was younger. So yeah, I don't like looking at that magazine. I know my mom keeps a copy in the living room and I always flip it upside down when I'm there. But yeah, I mean, I'm proud of the fact that someone who looks like me got on a magazine cover.
Yeah, it's so important. Have you noticed a change? Because I have a feeling that there seems to be a change in also in what the magazines do, what the brands choose for models.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I've seen a lot of positive changes, and I think really led by brands, and then, yeah, the media with storytelling will follow. But yeah, just making cycling inclusive has just been a really amazing shift just in the last, I would say, couple of years maximum. But that momentum seems to be going, and the more people we welcome into cycling and show them that it's not just for one type of human, but for lots of people, you know, the better the sport gets.
Yeah, totally agree. And I think in Germany, well, this is just starting. I think we are a little bit behind, as always, behind America or Canada. I know some really cool brands from Canada who are very progressive in this area, and also in the States, of course. Yeah. Which is cool.
Yeah, no, it's been amazing. Like, I signed with Bellocchio last year. Like, I'm just so honored every time I think about the fact that we're at a place now in cycling that I'm sponsored by one of the big clothing brands. And I just, yeah, I think they're so cool for doing that. And you're just seeing that coming out of all the brands now.
Back to racing. When you're like running or biking across these countries, you're also covering most of it by yourself. How do you do that? Like, do you take a camera? Because I can imagine it's extra weight, it's extra time you need for that.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think when I started, I just took a little GoPro and I didn't really know what I was doing with it, but I never thought a piece of technology could make me feel more connected to the outdoors. I always thought the opposite, but actually, you know, I'm quite guilty of just putting my head, if I'm doing an endurance sport, I just put my head down and I just hammer my legs and I don't look up and I don't look around and I don't stop. So taking a camera was like this obligation for me to stop more and look around me and try to fit it in a frame and tell the story of the place that I was in. So actually I found that having a camera with me just totally changed my mindset and made me go out into the mountains not thinking I'm here to cover X number of kilometers, but say I'm actually here to tell a story and to capture this place's story. And that just made me so much more connected. So I'm really surprised at myself that I actually really enjoy taking the camera with me.
That's so cool. And I think somewhere you said too, it takes you out of your zone, because usually, I mean, yeah, this is what athletes do. Athletes. When they, because I did the same with the transcontinental race. You can just switch to another zone, and time is not doesn't matter anymore.
Oh yeah, totally. I mean, I would get to my tent at the end of the day and want to write in my diary, and I wouldn't know what to tell my diary I did today. Like, I would have no memory of where I was or what I did. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, the zone is a fantastic place for covering miles, but it can just make the world disappear, which is nice, is a really nice thing. I love getting in the zone. But if you're there to travel and experience and explore, the zone can be a little bit of an enemy because it just sucks you in. And then, yeah, you could be anywhere. Like you said, you could be anywhere. It could be anytime. You have no idea.
Yeah, when you are on an expedition and it takes between 20 and 30 days, would you be in the zone for several days and then take out your camera, or is it something you do every day, or how does it look like?
Yeah, it totally changes, because yeah, there will be multiple days that I don't use the camera at all, and that just might be my vibe at the time, that I just want to be alone, or you know, I just haven't got anything to say. And then other days where all I do is mess around with the camera and I hardly do any running. So I just kind of go with the flow. I think the zone just kind of comes as soon as I start running. I can usually get into it pretty quickly if I'm in the mountains. So I'll usually kind of plan out my day and I'll say, right, I'm going to run this 12 kilometers. It's going to get me to this water point, and then I'll stop there and have a think and reset, and I'll just kind of do the whole day like that. So I'll maybe run for an hour and then pause, and then run for another hour and then pause. And so you're just kind of in and out.
All right. Okay. And before you go on an expedition, do you plan all these things? Do you know where the water spots are?
You know what? I used to do a really good job at that. I think in the beginning I was so nervous. Like when I went to Kyrgyzstan and no one had done it, so there was no guidebook and I just had no idea if it was possible. I was so nervous and I spent so much time working on my route. But the more of these I've done, the more I've just kind of built up this confidence and I'm like, I'll figure it out. It's fine. Like as long as I roughly know where I'm going and I'm aware if there are any serious stretches without resupply or water, especially, you know, if I just know kind of the hazards, then I otherwise just kind of go, and I just go for it and I just kind of like make it up as I go along. And I've really found that quite enjoyable actually, to just go to the start of a mountain range and then, you know, orientate myself in the right direction and say, all right, well, I'll just start running then. I'll just run until this is over. And, you know, you figure it out. If there are people living there, then that means it's possible to live there. And that's all you really need to know. If someone lives there, that means there is food and water. There is shelter. There is, you know, enough to support human life. So you'll be fine.
All right. Okay. And so you know kind of how fast you can, well, how far and how fast you can go, of course, and just trust that there will be water and food at some stage.
Yeah, and be mentally prepared that sometimes there won't be. I mean, mountains are unpredictable. You can't know that every river is going to have anything in it. You know, I've been slapped by that one quite a few times. Or, you know, I went to Bolivia, they were having a really hard season from climate change, and a lot of the shops were empty just because, you know, the transportation network wasn't working very well. So, you know, you always have to just be prepared for the fact that this might not go your way. You know, you're not doing a supported run. You're doing an expedition. You know, you're out there with no backup. You know, you've invented this for yourself, and it just might not work. It might not be your day. And you just have to be prepared to think on your feet and find another way to keep going. And yeah, I think it takes a level of blind courage where you're just kind of like, this could go really wrong, but I better not think about that too much or else I'll never start, you know, I'll be too scared.
Can you give us an example of something that went really wrong?
Yeah. So when I was doing the Atlas Mountains, actually, it was the start. I mean, the water was a really big problem. Obviously, a lot of the Atlas are in a pretty desert ecosystem. And where the Atlas start is where they kind of rise from the Sahara. It's a really cool place to go. You're kind of close to the border with Algeria. And you literally have sand all around you, except for on one side, just the starting of the rocks coming out of the sand and starting this mountain range. Like, so cool. But it was just way too hot and way too dry. I mean, there was no above ground water. I think I was on the fifth day when I finally saw a running river. So, I mean, that was how long I had to go without being able to get ample resupplies of water. And so anyways, I was just having a really hard time with the desert heat. So I decided I'll run at night instead. You know, that would be the perfect solution, is like during the day when it's too hot, I'll just move really slowly or find somewhere to get shade. But then at night, I will cover ground. And then what happened out of that was one night I couldn't see the edge of the trail and I ran off the side of it and I fell about 8 feet and landed on a pile of rocks and cut my hip open really badly. There was like quite a lot of blood. I couldn't believe that I hadn't broken anything. You know, it was such a painful fall. And I remembered the night before I had actually stayed with a Berber family, and the woman there had, I remember she was telling me a story about how a lot of Berber women still die in childbirth because it's too long to get to hospital. It's a 3-day drive to get to the hospital. And that number stuck in my mind, 3 days to get to hospital. So after I'd had this fall and I'd cut myself really badly, and I knew it wasn't a small cut. I knew I could probably use medical attention. But I just thought, 3 days to get to hospital, you know, that's too long. I can't do that. And then 3 days to get back. And, you know, so I just had to duct tape my wound shut and just kept on running. And it got so swollen. Like, I look back on some of the photos and I can just see it and just go, like, how did I mean, you know, you're out there in the mountains. There are no mirrors. So you never look at your body and realize how messed up it is. So it... and it got really infected because, of course, in Morocco, you have to be on the dress code. So I couldn't wear shorts to let this thing dry in the air. It was just inside my sweaty tights all day. And so it got really infected. And, you know, I just every day I had to ask myself what was more important to me. Did I want to finish this expedition, or did I want to go home, heal up, and then know that I'm going to have to wait until next year to try again? And, you know, every day I just decided, like, no, I can handle this pain. I can manage the infection. I can just keep on going, maybe slower than I wanted to. But, you know, every day I just had to have that conversation with myself. Like, how bad do you want it? Yeah. I mean, every time I look at that scar, I think, like, I have no regrets. It was worth it.
Yeah. So. Yeah. It sounds very much... like things that Jonas Deichmann told me, knowing your body so well that you know what you can do, and you're on a thin line, but you can walk it or run it or cycle it because you're aware of when you cross it, kind of.
That's really good. I think I'm gonna steal that from him, because I'm always trying to convince people, like parents or whatever, that, like, it's okay, I totally know what I'm doing, and I'm actually, it's all on gut feeling. Like, I just say, like, I know it's gonna be okay just because I know it's gonna be okay, and I can't really describe it. So I might just steal that from Jonas. That's a good one.
I'm sure you can. I'm a little bit I mean, I'm not on you guys level, and but I know that I used my body kind of knowledge from playing 20 years of rugby, and yeah, I use that in the transcontinental race because yeah,
you can take a beating.
Yeah. Yes, you can if you've played rugby for a while. Yes, you can. I mean, this is so individual, and you and Jonas and also other people, it's also, I think part of it is also your experience. I mean, you've done this for a while, and yeah.
Yeah, there's definitely no replacement for experience. And that's something that really excites me now, is realizing that I've got myself to a level where I feel experienced. You know, and, you know, 5 years ago, maybe I was a lot more nervous about things. But now I'm like, yeah, I just have these years and times that I've fallen off things and hurt myself and got myself into binds that I managed to get out of. And that just gives you so much more confidence that you're like, I've been through worse. I can pretty much always say I've been through something worse.
Yeah.
And that's just so freeing.
So you said you really have to want it. And in order to be in this mood or to really want something, there must be, like, we call it a higher reason in Germany, maybe your why. What's your why? Why do you do these expeditions?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I find it really hard to explain. The solo expeditions especially, I find it difficult to explain because it's so inherently selfish to go into the mountains all by yourself and just do it for you and no one else. I guess all I can say is that it makes me the best version of myself. It's where I'm like, I just feel like me. I feel happy. I feel like I'm where I belong, and I feel strong. And I know that if I keep on doing stuff like that, that makes me the best version of me, then the person who comes home from those trips, the person I am after I've done something like that, is the person who's most effective. I'm the best friend and sibling that I can be. I'm the best writer I could hope to be. I'm, you know, all the things that I care about, like making sport more inclusive and getting people into the outdoors. You know, I'm better at doing that when I'm the best version of me. And I think if everyone has that thing, and I think most people know what it is, but whatever that thing is that makes you your best, that makes you stoked and come alive, then, you know, do it as often as you can and be unapologetic about that.
Yeah, totally agree. Whatever it is.
Just do it.
Do it. Yeah, do it. One thing I noticed from far away in Germany is that you raise your voice, especially for women in cycling, and you raise your voice when you read a dumb comment on one of your videos. And this is just a hypothesis that maybe this is also part of your higher reason, because it comes so often and so, yeah, with so much passion. And when I did my research, I found this article written by you. I refound it. I'm not sure if the word exists. I had read it back in 2018, and I found it again. And the article was a reaction to a comment on one of your video of bikepacking or something alone as a woman. And the comment read, "A woman alone, a recipe for rape, unfortunately." And you reacted to it, and it really made like it changed something in my perception too, because I, for the first time, I noticed that I always had this thought, I shouldn't go out alone at night. I'm a woman, I have to, you know, act in a certain way. And yeah. Would you mind telling us a little bit about this?
Yeah, thanks for saying that. Yeah, you know, it's something that any outdoors woman is going to hear a lot, that you can't do things alone, you can't do things at night, you have to wear enough clothing no matter what the weather is. And it's this kind of victim-blaming mentality that your safe, a woman's safety is a woman's problem, that only the women have to make changes to the stuff that they do. So the part that really boggles my mind is that I get these reactions when I go do things that maybe other people don't do, like if I travel at all, if I go out on my bike or go out for a run. But no one ever says that when I, you know, take the train into London, which I would do many times a year living in the UK. And actually, you know, that's probably the bigger hazard, but it's this fear of women traveling. And then the thing that really puts me off is that people say this everywhere. I mean, every woman I know who does outdoor activities and every woman I know who travels has countless stories of being told that she's being irresponsible, that she can't, that she'll be in danger. And that's so discouraging and it's so limiting. And we're sending this message to women and girls that this is not for them, that, you know, sports are just for the big, strong men who can defend themselves, that, you know, women have to stay home and be safe. And that just keeps us limited. That holds us down. It's completely unfair. And, you know, my only argument is like, okay, none of this is good. Yes, violence against women is a real problem, but it's a problem everywhere. Whether or not I decide to go travel by bike, I'm going to have to make decisions about keeping myself safe. You know, just going to the shop, just going like anywhere in my local neighborhood, like I have to, you know, it's ingrained in us. We were taught so young to act a certain way as a woman that we don't even think about it until we stop. So I'm like, you know, I have to face these risks anyways, so I might as well travel the world and ride my bike and, you know, have the best life that I can. And I hope along the way we can address violence against women, but, you know, telling us just not to do stuff doesn't solve anything. It just perpetuates it.
And what I found striking in this article is that you wrote, well, in general, people are nice. I mean,
yeah. I mean, if I didn't believe that, I could never leave the house. And I think everyone's the same. Like, if you really thought the world is as full of bad people as that kind of YouTube commenter does, then how do you ever leave your front door? you know, you have to know that the society around you is mainly full of good people, that, you know, you are not at total risk every time that you leave the front door of your house. And, you know, it's something that's just, it's been a common truth in every country that I've been to where I was nervous going into it. I mean, I can't say it's been without incidents. You know, I am still a woman. I did travel to more than 70 countries by myself. Like, it, you know, but it's not, it's got nothing to do with travel. It's everywhere. But yeah, I've definitely met way more good people than bad. I mean, overwhelmingly more good people than bad. And, you know, I don't think that's unique. I think that anyone who starts to travel will see that and know that about the world. And it just, it warms your heart and builds you empathy for other humans. And yeah, it just, I mean, all I can keep saying is just keep coming home and telling people, like, trust me, that country is actually really nice. It's got nothing to do with the news. Like, the humans that live in it are lovely and they'll take care of you.
How would you recommend to prepare for certain countries like Morocco? Like, where's the balance between being aware of certain things but still being able to do it?
Yeah, it's hard. I think the best thing you can do is obviously just research the culture and know what is and isn't okay. Like, I mean, I always find places like that really difficult because as a feminist and someone who cares a lot about women's rights, I do find it really hard when I have to feel held back in like a dress code being a really obvious example. But you have to remember that you're a guest in that country. You don't get to bring your culture and impose it upon them. You have to, if you want to visit that country, you need to adapt to its culture. So all I would say to anyone would just be to thoroughly research and understand what the differences are going to be in that country. And, you know, just do your best to show the locals that you are respectful. Even if you don't agree with it, you can still respect it and follow along. And if you can't respect it, then it's going to be a really hard holiday for you. So yeah, it's one that always kind of tears me up a little bit when it comes to women's rights. But yeah, if you're going to visit that culture, the best you can do for it is to at least respect it and join it, and, you know, that's actually, I think, the best way to connect.
I always think if the women see you there, even though you're in the dress code and you are, as you said, respectful, I mean, they still see there's a woman doing things out there alone and she can do it.
Yeah, I was really hopeful in the Atlas race because obviously the villages that, you know, 200 bicycles whizzed through. So obviously, like, people were watching us and it drew a lot of attention. And I remember in the earlier days of the race when we were still so bunched up that you could hear other riders ahead and behind you. And me and a girl called Scotty Luchiga, who was in a pair with her husband, she was the closest woman to me. And I could hear when her and I went through the villages, there was just like louder screams from, you know, the schoolgirls, and the women would see these, that amongst all these bicycles, there were a couple of girls, and they would get so excited. And every time that I heard, like if I could hear right ahead of me, Scotty getting cheered for, I was just like, yes, like the women have noticed us. And I just hope they remember the day that they saw a bike race that had all these chicks in it.
I get goosebumps when you tell this. And the original reason, well, one of them why we wanted to talk was also your book, because I've talked about your book so many times in this podcast.
Aww,
and
thank you.
It's called Tough Women Adventure Stories, and yeah, about stories of grit, courage and determination. And what you've done is you asked, I'm not sure, 30 women roughly, how many?
22. Oh, I think it's 22. I don't even know.
Yeah.
I just
plenty.
Spent a year making it, but I don't even know.
Well, basically you invited, well, you tell us.
I guess in my career, I get asked all the time why there aren't more women in the outdoor industry. And I always really struggled with that because in my job, I work with women all the time. You know, you and I are on a podcast right now. We both happen to be women. You know, it,
surprise,
the outdoor
surprise.
Industry is, see, they're everywhere.
I know.
So I think it's just, you know, women are very active in the outdoor industry and do have really good jobs. But when it came to the highest level, like what you see on TV and who gets the big books that are at the front window of the bookshop, you tend to only see one type of person, and then you only get one type of narrative. And so this book was my answer to everyone that asked me why there aren't more women in the outdoor industry, is I can hand them the book and say, here, every single woman in this book is employed in the outdoor industry in completely different capacities. They're from all over the world. They do all different things, but they've all found their path here. And this is a place for women. This is an inclusive environment. And it's just a celebration and giving a platform to women who just deserve to have their stories told. And, you know, when I reached a point in my career that I was able to get a book deal that could do that for these women, that was, you know, a huge life goal for me. So that's really what it's about. It's just a really positive book of stories that just come from women who have their own embodiment of the word tough.
Yeah, I absolutely love it. Just to read out a few names, I have it in my hand right now. Anna McNuff, Emily Chappell, then a German, Paula Flach. Yes, I started following her, and she writes about,
she's brilliant.
Yeah, moss and tough skin, and she, yeah, it's a very, very interesting story. And all these stories have kind of a part where the women had to take were challenged, and they tell you how they solved the challenge. And yeah, it's really interesting because they are, of course, different ways, but there are also certain parallels. Paula Flach describes something as mental hygiene. So something happened, then she describes how she continues after that. And that reminded me so much of your experience when you were in Kyrgyzstan and you wanted to quit.
Yeah, I had said that I would quit. But, you know, when you have that happen in the wilderness, the great thing is that you can't quit. You still have to get to a town where there's a bus that can take you home. So I think I had 2.5 days or something like that. So I'd said I would quit, but I still had 2.5 days I had to get through in order to get out to civilization and actually quit. So, you know, I had 2.5 days to sort my head out and unquit, if that's not a word, but, you know, find new joy in what I was doing and find new reason and give myself my courage back.
The interesting thing is that it's often harder to quit than to just continue, because you're, like, yeah, you said, in the wilderness. And yeah, but it's a great book. I can recommend it again. I'll put it in the show notes. It's amazing. And
thanks very much.
Yeah. I especially, like you said, you're, I mean, it's why I asked you, you're covering your own expeditions, your races. A lot of athletes who do these things, or expeditioners, are often quite focused on themselves. And this is such a refreshing project to look at other women's stories.
Yeah, I mean, it meant so much to me to be in a position that I could lift other people up and share their stories with a wider audience. And yeah, it's same for you with the podcast. Like, you know, this, our sport or our hobbies, passions are just richer by having more people in them. So, you know, the more people that you bring along for the ride, then the better.
Exactly. And you know what? I mean, this is a, I don't actually have a podcast, you know, studio. I'm doing this from at home, like most people, especially now where you're not allowed to go anywhere. And this often means that my kids are not allowed to use the internet while I'm, you know, talking to you, because
this is a huge sacrifice.
This is huge. They're so cool because they know this is so important. And today, my daughter, who is 11 years old, they said, oh, this is a very important woman I'm talking to tonight.
Oh, no way. Yeah. Oh, this is the best compliment I've ever received.
And you know what? She said, yes, I have to ask you for an autograph. So,
okay.
Yeah, we have to see how we make this happen.
I will sort that out.
She's 11 and she gets to hear all these stories, and I'm always talking about the women on my podcast. So we have to talk about this. But before that, we're coming close to the end. And in the end, I'm always asking two questions. The first one is, who has inspired you as a person?
Yeah, I find that a difficult question because I think I didn't have like that one celebrity athlete to look up to. And this circles back to your daughter. I mean, when I was 11, I didn't see someone like me doing the stuff that I wanted to do. You know, I always wanted to be an explorer, but I didn't see anyone who looked like me. And, you know, if you can't see it, you can't be it. That's what they always say. And that's why we need role models of all different shapes and sizes and genders and orientations. So I didn't have someone to look up to. So I just kind of made things up for myself. And that's probably why I ended up this way, doing the things that I do that are quite unique, because I just thought, well, there's no path for me. There's no obvious route to take. So I'll just do whatever I want and, you know, create something. So and that's why it was important to me to think about being a role model and providing role models, you know, with the book that's full of, you know, you'll find someone in there that you can identify with, hopefully more than one person, but certainly there will be someone in there that has some kind of resemblance to you and your daughters.
Actually, many people have more idols or more inspiring person than just one, and just take something out of all these persons. So
totally.
Yeah. And besides your own book that we have promoted already and that I can highly recommend, it's great as a gift as for yourself or whoever, is there another book you can recommend?
Ooh, oh, difficult question. A book that I go back to a lot, and it's from really loving Scotland and also this different narrative of the mountains, a book called The Living Mountain by Nan Shepherd. She was a Scottish mountaineer way back in the day when women definitely couldn't be doing this stuff. And what I really love about the way that she writes is that it's so unique of that time period, that to just write about being in the mountains rather than conquering the mountains. You know, the male narrative was always getting to the top and planting the country's flag, whereas she has just more of a poetic appreciation for the time amongst the mountains as a passenger. So Nan Shepherd, that's what I would go to recommend.
Awesome. I'll put that in the show notes as well, and I think I have another book on my own list to read. This is really good. When I started implementing these questions, it was not for selfish reasons, but I've almost read all the books that people have.
There you go. That's a great way to get a reading list. Just start a podcast. What could be easier?
Yeah, it's a good outcome. And I have another question for you. I saw that you tried to do the Ride Far challenge Orbit. And did you give it another go?
No. I've really broken up with road cycling, to be honest with you. I guess it, like, the pandemic, I've always, like, arrived finishing at home. I've just kind of, like, got more into mountain biking and gravel riding, and I haven't got back to distance yet this year. I will get back to distance, but yeah, at the moment where I live, there isn't even 180 kilometers worth of anything. I'm like in a small town sheltered by the mountains. You can't go that far.
Thanks so much for your time. It's been a big pleasure for me to talk to you.
And me as well. Thanks for having me.
I hope we'll meet one day, maybe.
I know. Soon.
Maybe it's possible again one time.
Yeah, it will be possible. It will happen. Can't wait.
Yeah, me too. And yeah, thanks so much and good luck, and especially for your next mountain rage running.
Thank you.
Maybe during summer. Which one is left?
Europe. So I hope to do the Caucasus, but I don't know.
Yeah. So where would you start and how would that look like?
I would start in Abkhazia, which is an autonomous region in Georgia. And I would follow kind of as close to the Russian border as I could without crossing it. But there are obviously autonomous regions in the way, like South Ossetia and Chechnya, that you have to run around. And then so get through Georgia, and then halfway through you cross into Azerbaijan and run towards probably Baku, the capital of Azerbaijan. That's plan A. I mean, with the pandemic, I'm never planning anything more than a few weeks in advance because you just don't know if things will change. So that's plan A. If it doesn't go ahead, Europe has plenty of other mountains that might be open. So, you know.
All right. So you just choose one who...
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Not this one you have to... I mean, this... Because I remember there's challenges where, you know, on this continent, you have to do this mountain range.
I know. I invented this challenge. I made up the rules. It's so good.
Awesome. Well, have a great day. It's in the morning for you. So I hope you're going to enjoy a great ride somewhere. And
I am going to go ride now.
Perfect. Awesome. So won't keep you indoors any longer. Thank you so much. And
awesome.
Yeah,
thank
see you.
You
soon. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
What an impressive person. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. The interview showed me once again that there is often much more behind the facade than is apparent at first glance. Insecurity and doubt can be so close to superhuman performance. Talking about self-doubts, I was unsure whether I could do an interview in English that meets my standards. I guess there's air to the top, as we say in German, but I'm really happy with the outcome. So stay tuned for more international guests in future. And I almost forgot. The Wundersame Fahrradwelt has a new website and I linked it in the show notes for you. And until the 18th, vote for me for the German Podcast Prize, which I also linked in the show notes. I'd be the happiest person in the world if you check out my website, see if you like it, vote for me, so maybe I have a chance to win it. Thanks so much.